Support for News comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting the Future of Nursing Campaign for Action in 50 states at rwjf.org.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is The Daily Circuit, along with Tom Weber. Hey, Tom, do you think the power of forgiveness is overrated? Is there value to holding a grudge?
What? Well, I think in my family there is. There seems to be.
You're a family of grudge holders?
I could point out a few.
We're talking about that in depth a little later.
Carrie, I'm also going to talk to the chair of the House Higher Education Committee. We're poring over the state budget that was passed this week, so we're going to talk about higher ed here in just a few moments. Also leading regional news, more from Lilydale Park. One St. Louis Park fourth grader is still missing in that park after a mudslide yesterday. This morning, the family of that boy is in the park as recovery efforts continue. Authorities allowed two of the boy's uncles and other family members to approach the site of the collapse. A third uncle who arrived at the scene, Mohammed Ba, identified the missing boy as Mohammed Fofana. The boy is believed to be buried under mud and debris. One other child was killed after being buried yesterday when the hillside collapsed. Two others were injured. The students are from Peter Hobart Elementary School. They were on a field trip in the park, which is known for fossil hunting. A change in state law that will make it easier to track metal and car thieves is headed to the governor for his signature. Tim Nelson has more.
Lawmakers passed more stringent documentation requirements for people selling scrap metal and automobiles. The change is in response to thefts of building materials, irrigation equipment, and a rash of car thefts in 2011. Ramsey County Attorney John Choi said nearly 100 vehicles were simply towed off the street and taken to be crushed for scrap, sometimes before their owners even knew the vehicles were missing.
The current law today is that if your car is over 6 years of age, you don't have to prove that you own the vehicle by way of a title. And that just needed to change. So now under the new legislation, any car that's scrapped has to have proof of ownership, i.e. a title.
There are some exemptions for older cars. The law will also beef up documentation requirements for other scrap metal sales. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Governor Dayton says he has not yet decided whether he'll make changes in the legacy bill that was passed earlier this year. Several Republican and DFL lawmakers have asked the governor to use his line item veto authority to strike two projects that were funded in the bill. They object to allocations for metropolitan regional parks and efforts to stop aquatic invasive species because neither project was endorsed by a citizens panel that helps decide how legacy money should be spent. That's from the legacy amendment sales tax that was approved a few years ago by voters. Dayton says he expects to announce a decision by the end of this week.
My staff is compiling information, and I certainly have heard from many organizations, and I've heard from organizations in support of those measures.
The Nature Conservancy and nearly two dozen other habitat and sportsmen's groups are also asking the governor to veto part of that bill. There's a funeral this morning in Stillwater for Zach Zobiak, the teenager whose farewell song became a YouTube and iTunes sensation in recent weeks. Zobiak died Monday of bone cancer at the age of 18. His mother, Laura, said on Zach's Caring Bridge website that he was surrounded by his family and girlfriend. Zach was diagnosed with osteosarcoma in 2009. When he learned last year he didn't have much longer to live, he wrote a song called Clouds, which has gotten more than 4 million views in just the past 2 weeks. And that is the latest regional news here on the Daily Circuit, though we continue to pore over what is and wasn't in the final state budget that was approved this week at the state capitol. You're now going to hear about higher education. Dollar-wise, it was a $2.8 billion budget. That's a $250 million increase in there combined for the University of Minnesota and the Minscu system. DFL State Representative Gene Pawlowski of Winona joins me now. He chairs the House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. Welcome back to the show, Representative.
Yes, thank you for having me on.
This bill includes tuition freeze at both the U and Minscu. There is also, though, extra funding in the budget as a way to make up for that loss. What's also being done?
Well, wait, let's be clear here. There's okay. No loss to either system. This tuition freeze should be characterized as tuition stability. What we did, the systems requested 3% each year of the biennium, 6% for each system. We paid that instead of students. So both systems are getting a base increase of 6% that would have been paid by students, but that is now paid by the state. So there's no loss of revenue. In fact, they're getting that base increase, which is a sizable sum of money, $78 million for the Minsky system and $42 million for the University of Minnesota.
What's also being done then to control and cut costs going forward?
Well, for students, the other aspect of this bill is an increase of over $60 million in the grant program and the creation of a new type of student in the grant program, the part-time student. This is a student who went through the Great Recession. They may have had a foreclosure. Their family may have lost all of their savings that would have gone to higher education. They're more than likely working at a full-time job at a very small salary, and they're trying to get an education. We're targeting that student in a special pilot program. That's going to be about $30 million to see if we can help that type of student. As far as oversight, we combine both the House and Senate. In the House bill, we had the legislative auditor draft reporting mechanisms over the next 5 years. Those reporting mechanisms will help us better understand the budgets of the University of Minnesota and the Minsky system. This restores legislative oversight. We need to know why these tuitions are going up, where the money is being spent, and in particular, the accusations of administration. I think there is cause for concern when you're looking at administrative salaries that are so high, when you're looking at bonuses, and this bill, by the way, eliminates bonuses for administrators in the University of Minnesota and the Minsky system.
It eliminates that state funding that these state appropriations could be used for those bonuses.
Well, right? I would put it this way. The way it's crafted, they'd be hard-pressed to put this in a contract. And since we're going to be overseeing how they're spending their money, we better not see a bonus or a merit pool or any other type of jargon used for bonuses. These salaries are the highest salaries of employees in the state of Minnesota. They're hundreds of thousands of dollars. You took the job. It's public service. You shouldn't expect an exorbitant salary and a bonus.
You know, the accountability you noted there, there's a lot of reporting that has to be done to the legislature. How is it going to be, you know, one of the threats there or risks is that it just becomes a bunch of reports on the shelf. How do you anticipate going forward so that the accountability actually follows after all these reports are due?
Well, on the Senate side, we incorporated their mechanism, which says if they don't match what the legislature has prescribed, we're withholding 5% of their budgets. So they're going to have to ensure that they have matched these aren't exactly targets in the sense. We're telling them, here's how we directed you to spend the money. You have to come back and prove to us that you spent it that way. On the House side, the reporting mechanisms are when they present their budget, they're going to have to present the budget in specificity. If it's a 3% increase in tuition, all right, then why is it 3%? Where is it going? And if you're proposing new program, that new program better be what you say it is. And this is where we've had some difficulty. They apparently have decided to take base increases, label it new program, when in effect it should have been labeled something else. And then they come back and say, well, you didn't give us this new program and we have to make cuts. Well, it's a new program. How in the world do you have to make cuts over something you don't have now? And that's ended. They're going to have to tell us up front exactly what it's for and in two pots. If you're increasing tuition for it, how much? If you want straight up state appropriation, how much?
So there's an increase in this year's budget, but do you anticipate, and I'm not talking about meeting these goals, I'm talking about after these reports come in and you see how the money is spent, do you anticipate down the road that you would then want to make more specific cuts down the line based on what those reports show?
I would say they wouldn't be term cuts. They'd be withholding because the systems did not honor what the legislature had prescribed.
Given that there's a big debate, especially about the U, the University of Minnesota is older than the state of Minnesota, so it has a lot of constitutional autonomy. Are you ever really going to be able to have a strong thumb to press down on the U to get what you want in terms of these accountability measures?
I think given the way the regents election went this past session, and the hammering that the U took on administrative, just the sheer number of administrators, on administrative salaries, on administrative bonuses, they don't want any more bad press. they would like some good press. Well, the better press would be to come in and say, here's what we've done to answer all of these concerns and questions and to detail for us how it's been done. That's why we're going to have interim hearings, and we'll have hearings all the way up to the start of session in February to make sure that we're prepared when session starts if we need legislation to even deepen this oversight.
Do you are you worried at all with the way the freeze was implemented? And then you noted that you also have state funding now, so it doesn't fall on the students. But does that set a bad precedent in simply saying we'll freeze tuition, but the state will make up for it, and there's no controlling down the road on that?
Well, that's the way it used to be. What the two systems have done, both the regents and the trustees, anytime we made cuts, first of all, neither one of them complained, even though these cuts were historically deep and over a long period of time. They did two things very well. They raised tuition by historic numbers, and they also allowed administrators to be paid extremely high salaries and then bonuses for it. So I don't think they have any credibility when it comes to tuition. It's better. We're the ones that are making the tough choices. We raised revenue to allow this to occur. Governor Dayton was the one that insisted that we start reinvesting in higher education at $250 million, and we agreed, but we also then raised revenue to do it.
You know,
so we're going to be accountable in 2014. They're accountable to nobody.
Representative Gene Pawlowski with us from Winona, chairs the Higher Ed Finance Committee and Policy Committee there in the House. Representative Pawlowski, you've been a very outspoken critic, especially of the U. You don't mince words, I will say. But I'm curious, what is it going to take? What do you need to see for you to come back on this show in a few months or a year or two and start singing the U's praises to be absolutely complimentary of what they've done?
I think we have sung their praises in the area that the U does best, research. They're outstanding in research facilities. I think the problem has been over the last 8 years that the legislature did not do its role in legislative oversight. We simply made cuts. We assumed that those cuts are going to be done in a beneficial way and in a way that wouldn't be excessive. Well, they weren't. We also didn't even take a look at administrative salaries and bonuses. So I'm hoping that over the next year and a half, what we will see will be both systems, not just the U, but MinSCU too, come back and say, we heard what Minnesota said. We're making changes, and those changes are for the betterment of the student and higher education.
I want to talk about two other items that were in the higher education budget here before we let you go. The DREAM Act was included in this legislation. This will allow students with non-legal immigration status to get in-state tuition, be eligible for financial aid as well. I am curious, though, why was this included in the budget and not passed as a separate policy piece?
It could go either way. The Senate did pass it as a separate policy piece, well, actually a fiscal piece. It has a fiscal note of about $100,000. This was probably in anticipation of the immigration laws that are being changed in Washington, D.C. There was support for it. I had some questions about it, and I think those questions will be answered in the next year and a half, particularly if Congress passes the new immigration law.
What are your questions?
My question is exactly how do we define this type of student? We do not in Minnesota regulate immigration. That's a federal issue. They have to define for us exactly what type of services, what type of things we can give to an individual who isn't characterized as a citizen. And the federal government's going to have to help us with that.
What if there is no immigration law, although it looks like there's some momentum at this point, does the state legislature have to come back?
I think our big issue is in the grant program, because the Pell is really the feeder for the grant program. We can say that we can honor in-state tuition for these students, and that's what we're going to do. I think when you get to the grant program, we begin to have some difficulties because of the definitions that are used in the Pell, which then drives the state grant program. So I think your comment that the tuition part of it, we are in control of. The grant part of it, I think the federal government's in control of.
Final point here with that I'd like to talk to you about here with Representative Pawlowski. There's actually some debate over a pretty relatively small part of the budget. It's a $1.5 million allocation for the organization Teach for America. This is an organization that recruits and trains recent college grads to teach. And as you know, Representative, Teach for America is a divisive organization for some people in education circles. There's a lot of people who don't have a lot of gray area. They either love it or they hate it. And now I understand there's consideration the governor might line item veto that $1.5 million out of the budget. Why would he do that, and do you think he should?
When we met with Governor Dayton, he does not oppose Teach for America. He simply says that we should not be paying for it. The item did remain in the conference committee report. I fully expect the governor is going to line item veto that portion of the bill. In fact, I sent him a letter supporting the line item veto, saying that if the governor is more comfortable with that, that money could then be used somewhere else next year, for instance, in the grant program. So this was a Senate provision, not a House provision. The governor disagrees with it, and I think you're going to see a line item veto.
This is something that has gotten state funding, though, before in the past. Isn't the line item vetoing of it, though, a sign that maybe the support is waning?
There's a new legislature and a new governor and a new session. Times have changed.
Do you support Teach for America?
I don't have any argument against it. We compromised. I don't support giving money to it, but there was a compromise in this bill, and the big compromise for the House was stabilizing tuition. That was our biggest goal, and we did it in both systems, so I'll take a big win and sometimes a small loss to move forward.
TFL Representatives Gene Pawlowski from Winona, thanks as always for coming back to the show and telling us about the budget here that passed this week. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
In other news this hour, Carrie, a global stock market slump is continuing on Wall Street today as traders worry about how committed the Fed remains to keeping up its bond-buying program. The Dow lost more than 100 points in the opening minutes of trading this morning. Stocks were also down in Germany, France, and Japan today. Investors were spooked by minutes from the last Fed meeting that indicate several policymakers are leaning towards slowing that central bank bond-buying program. That program has kept and keeping interest rates low and encouraging investors to buy risky assets like stocks. The number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits fell by 23,000 last week. It's further evidence the job market is slowly returning to health. Still, though, the Labor Department reports much of the improvement has come not necessarily from hiring, but simply from fewer layoffs. A U.S. senator says repeated sexual assaults in the military allow a culture to continue. Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand of New York addressed the latest case at West Point. That's where an Army sergeant is charged with secretly taking pictures and video of at least a dozen women. Gillibrand told NBC's Today Show that when sexual assault happens repeatedly with no accountability, quote, it allows the culture to continue. Gillibrand sits on the Armed Services Committee in the Senate. She says sexual assault should be reported outside the chain of command directly to a military prosecutor, and victims need to know that justice is possible. More coming up here on The Daily Circuit.
It has certainly been an active few weeks when it comes to the weather. I'm Phil Picardi. On Friday's Morning Edition, U of M meteorologist Mark Seely will stop by with a recap and let us know what to expect over the Memorial Day weekend. Tune in weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m.
This is The Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News. Follow us on Twitter. We're at Daily Circuit.
I'm Carrie Miller, and now we're in depth on why forgiveness may not be so divine. It's supposedly the mark of a mature and compassionate person, someone who can rise above the impulse to hold a grudge and be virtuous and forgiving. But social scientists aren't so convinced, and neither are our guests. Today, a conversation about why the research is mixed on the power of forgiveness and why pushing yourself to forgive too soon can have the opposite effect. Two guests are going to join us. I hope you will, too. Are you struggling to forgive someone right now? Is your head and your heart telling you that you should? Or are you more comfortable with the grudge that you're holding? Tell me why. Tell me about that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can reach us on the Daily Circuit page. Click on the Hour Show to comment. And you can also reach me on Twitter and tell me about it, at @CarrieMPR. Jeffrey Murphy is a professor of law and philosophy at Arizona State University. He's co-editor of the book Before Forgiveness, and he's with us today from Phoenix. And Jeffrey Murphy, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Simon Doonan is with us. He's a writer and creative ambassador to Barney's New York. He's the author of Confessions of a Window Dresser. He's recently been writing about this, and he's with us from New York. And Simon, welcome to you. It's good to have you here.
How are you?
I'm good. You wrote a recent piece for Slate.com in which you said, we've all gotten a little squishy and confused about forgiveness. How so?
Well, I guess I kept reading these gruesome stories in the news, and In every case, there was an instance where the victim had sort of made a rush to forgiveness. Even, you know, the uncle of Pistorius. There were many examples that I gave in the piece and in the run-up to when I wrote that article. And obviously, there's a huge range of actions that people apply the term forgiveness to. But it just seemed to me that somehow or other, people were unable to when something really, really dreadful and obviously unforgivable had happened, something that would really, you know, just basically ruin your life, there was an attempt to sort of seek peace through the idea of forgiveness. And to me, it seems like, you know, I always think of the example of in one's 20s, we all do reckless, thoughtless things. It's the nature of being a young adult. And those are the kinds of things that obviously you should just forgive and let go. You know, the little infidelities and inconsiderate acts that, you know, can be enormously irritating. But then when that same idea of forgiveness, let's hug it out and move on, is applied to these really catastrophic murders, kidnappings, whatever, that I sort of have a hard time with.
Yeah, I wonder, Jeffrey Murphy, in listening to Simon talk about that, if there's a kind of societal or peer pressure to forgive. I mean, supposedly that's the greatest act of compassion that you can give.
Well, there's no doubt, and he mentions this quite nicely in the piece in Slate. There's a kind of movement of forgiveness boosterism that is, I think, fairly pervasive in America right now. I think there are a variety of reasons why that might be true. But if you just go over to the self-help and recovery section in any bookstore, you're going to find the word forgiveness. And I would guess a fourth of the titles, and it's all unambiguously sentimental, pro-forgiveness, without even considering the possibility that there may, under certain circumstances, be some downsides to forgiveness.
Well, you said there are a number of reasons about why we may be kind of in this place in our culture. What are they?
Well, I'm no social scientist. I'm a philosopher and a law professor, so I don't want to pretend that I know a lot of empirical knowledge that I don't have. But I guess for some people, I think it seems to me a sentimental and extreme interpretation of certain strands of Christianity. I was recently debating with a Christian theologian about this, and he was quoting passages from Scripture that he said show that Christianity requires unconditional, unambiguous, unhesitant forgiveness. And one passage he quoted was Jesus' remark from the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." I said, wait a minute, that doesn't sound unconditional to me. It sounds like he's saying they had an excuse. They didn't know what they were doing. It would have been unconditional had he said, "Father, forgive them, even though they know damn well what they're doing."
Yeah.
And I think some Christians conveniently ignore, for example, again, I don't pose as a theologian, but there's a remark made by Jesus in Luke, and if anybody should know anything about Christianity, I presume it's Jesus. And he says, "If thy brother sin against thee, rebuke him, and if he repents, forgive him." That's making forgiveness conditional on a change of heart and a genuine, sincere attempting to make amends on the part of the wrongdoer.
Yeah, Simon, I think there is something to the religious side of this, because I mean, the saying that I was kind of referring to err is human, to forgive divine, that we should try to reach for that divine inspiration to be forgiving, that we're better people because of it.
Yeah, I think in my article I mentioned that in the past, the forgiveness was doled out only by divinities, you know, so we didn't take that upon ourselves. That was something that came from Jesus, God, or, you know, wherever your religious center was, and that now people through New Age, you know, the increase in unstructured, New Agey kind of religious thought, people are sort of grabbing onto that. Whereas in the past, people thought, well, I can't do that because I'm not a deity, I'm not a divinity. You know, they'll be sorted out when the Day of Judgment comes. It's not for me to say, you know, you're to be forgiven. They have to live with what they've done, and terrible actions have terrible consequences.
If you're tuned in, if you've just joined us this hour, we're talking about the power of forgiving or not, or the virtue in sometimes holding a grudge when it seems like the right way to be in a specific situation. Simon Doonan is with us. He recently wrote a very interesting piece about it at Slate.com. And Jeffrey Murphy thinks about this as a professor of law and philosophy at Arizona State University. I'm interested in how you come to this conversation. Are you right now in the midst of trying to forgive someone? Why do you feel like you have to be forgiving?
Well, I don't feel, I don't know if you're asking me. Or
no, Jeffrey, I'm asking the audience, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. So I'll put the phone number out and then I will turn that question to you. Why do you feel like you have to be forgiving? Is there societal pressure to be forgiving, or are you comfortable with the grudge, whatever grudge that is that you're holding? Here's the number, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. Talk to me about it on Twitter. I've gotten some great tweets, at @CarrieMPR. And go to the Daily Circuit page and click on the Hour Show to comment to David in Minneapolis. Hi, David.
Hi there.
Hi. What do you want to say about this?
Well, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
This, obviously, anybody that has had this issue is going to be pretty personal about it. But my fiance was responsible for the death of one of our children, and we are in the midst of custody over another child.
Sounds difficult.
It is very difficult, but the hardest part, I think, is trying to force myself to forgive, because I need to look to the life of our daughter instead of looking back on the passing of our son. And my ex doesn't take any responsibility for her part in it, which is even harder to try to forgive somebody who doesn't believe that they're responsible when you know that they are. And you guys just brought the religious point into it, and you know, right after the whole custody thing started, she immediately turned to religion and Christianity and started saying, well, you know, it's Jesus forgives me, so you have to too.
Wow. Jeffrey, I mean, this is one of those, I think this kind of brings us back to where we started here, which is societal pressure to be forgiving, but the other side of which says, but are you going to live in that toxic state of nurturing that grudge and potentially passing that on to your child?
Well, people vary in the degree to which the resentments and the angers they harbor are toxic. I think one of the flaws I probably have is probably part of my genetic Irish history. As one of my flaws is I really enjoy being angry. I never feel more invigorated than when I'm really angry at somebody. And so I have to fight down the tendency to overdo my vindictiveness. But I do think people vary enormously. And I think one of the things I've tried to argue against in my writings on forgiveness is I'm very skeptical of any universal prescriptions like always forgive or never forgive.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been more concerned to point out the dangers of what I call hasty forgiveness. And you quoted that famous line, to err is human, to forgive divine. I always like to quote H.J. Perelman's variation on that, to err is human, to forgive supine. And that is sometimes a hasty tendency to forgive means you just aren't standing up and showing enough self-respect and taking yourself seriously as a person who deserves to be treated well.
And yet, Simon, in David's situation, his ex-fiance is moving on with her life and seems to be quite sure that she can move on unencumbered by whatever grudge that he's holding. So who is this going to hurt the most for him to hold the grudge? Probably him.
Except I actually feel that in a situation like the caller situation, which is truly heartrending, it sounds really, really complex and challenging. In that situation, I guess what you might strive for is to have a functional relationship with the facts and with the children and with the spouse, but maybe the act of I don't know the circumstances, but the act might be deemed to be unforgivable, but you might compartmentalize that somehow. So that act was unforgivable. I don't forgive it, but I'm going to strive to have a functional relationship with you because for the benefit of our children. And so, you know, those are the kinds of things I think people used to wrestle with more, whereas now it's sort of almost un-PC to say, I don't forgive you.
Yeah,
for
exactly.
That.
Exactly.
But I'm going to strive to have a functional interaction with you that isn't sort of completely tainted by that. But obviously, it's going to be difficult. But I don't need to forgive you for something that is so devastating. And obviously, I'm, you know, I don't know the full circumstances.
Simon, how important do you think some sense of contrition is? I think it's hard to remain unforgiving of someone if there is true contrition.
I disagree. I think if somebody has done something absolutely terrible, catastrophic, that's had enormous impact, they should probably never be forgiven for that. If they're contrite, then that's an appropriate state for them to aspire to. You know, the perpetrator of the unforgivable act should aspire to a state of contrition. And if they get there, then great. That's good for them. But it doesn't impact my relationship to the original act,
Jeffrey,
which was an unforgivable act.
Jeffrey, how do you see that?
Well, I think it depends, and I think this is a point that Simon made earlier and in the piece he wrote for Slate. It depends on how grave the wrong that is. I think that sometimes if a person shows contrition, they repent, they apologize, and we think it's sincere, although we're in a culture now where it's hard not to be cynical about apology. But if we have all of that and the wrong is not what we call unforgivable, then I think that does open the door to forgiveness because the person is sort of saying, well, look, okay, I did this terrible thing, and I now stand with you in condemning it.
Right.
That makes it easier for me to forgive. On the other hand, if it's, you know, had Adolf Eichmann said, you know, gee, I'm real sorry, even if we thought that was true, I don't quite think, given what he was responsible for, forgiveness of him is incumbent because of his contrition.
Let me grab a call here from Dean in Minneapolis. Good morning, Dean. Thanks for waiting.
Sure.
Hi. Go ahead.
I think there's a wide range of types of forgiveness, and I think a distinction that isn't being made here is that forgiveness is not granting absolution for the wrong that has been committed. In therapeutic forgiveness and marriage forgiveness and stuff like that, it's about letting go of the anger and letting go of the grudge. And there's actually a great punchline from the Buddha. If you hold a grudge, it's like drinking rat poison and expecting the rat to die. So it's not about the perpetrator. It's about letting go of the anger in your own life. And it's a Muslim thing, and it's a Buddhist thing, and it's a Christian thing. When Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, Jesus is not forgiving them. Jesus is asking God to forgive them. So even Jesus had his own limitation on forgiveness.
Jeffrey, how about that?
Well, I like I said earlier, I'm very suspicious of any universal prescriptions. I think some people, if that allows them to gain peace by forgiving, even if I would regard it as a case where I wouldn't forgive quite so easily or quickly, then who am I to comment on the way they gain peace? What I don't like is this kind of moralizing from people about there's something mentally deficient about you or something morally deficient about you if you don't forgive. I think there are circumstances when it would be presumptuous to say to a victim, you know, well, gee, really, you know, if you were a better person, if you were a more mentally healthy person, you would forgive.
Well, you don't even have to explicitly say that, but often that seems to be the implication.
Yeah, and I think talking about something Simon said a few minutes ago, and the previous caller about important distinctions, I think it's very important to draw a distinction between forgiveness and reconciling with or working with, because the South Africa, as you may know, had this famous Truth and Reconciliation Commission,
right,
which, interestingly enough, in spite of, I think, a lot of pressure from Bishop Desmond Tutu to try to make this appear an exercise in Christian forgiveness, they did not call it the Truth and Forgiveness Commission. This was basically, if people who committed these terrible atrocities under the previous regime will come forward, admit fully what they did, and take full responsibility for what they did, even if they don't apologize, even if they don't say they're sorry, we will reconcile with them, give them amnesty, because the goal here is to be able to work together cooperatively to build a just and decent democratic future for South Africa.
Right.
But the idea, underlying idea, is if you still want to hate these people in your heart of hearts, by all means, go ahead and do it.
I want to see if Dean is still on the line.
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you think of that?
Well, again, we're talking about a range of behaviors. Krista Tippett, in her book Einstein's God, interviews a neurologist who says that vengeance is hardwired into our brain. It can leap into our head the same way a massive hunger does if you haven't eaten for 2 days and you see your favorite meal. But the evolutionary adaptation to that is a sense of forgiveness, because it's a way of reconciling within the tribe so that you don't kill everybody in the tribe. So both vengeance and forgiveness are hardwired into our heads, and it's a matter of how we manage it.
And yet I was looking at research from Jim McNulty out of Florida State, who finds that if forgiveness happens too quickly, too readily, the person who's being forgiven doesn't change their behavior, which is ultimately the goal here, right?
I disagree. You're not trying to change anybody's behavior except your own. It's a matter of reconciling with whether you're going to let that perpetrator have all that real estate in your head, that you're going to let them be the focus of your anger and your rage, or if you're going to let go of that and move on.
But what? How could you let go if you and I do? I hear clearly what you're saying. But mm-hmm. How about the letting go, with the awareness that the person went out and did it again, or continues to behave in a similar way? What's the point then of the forgiveness?
Well, there's specific examples. There's a play called Marietta about a Catholic woman who forgave the kidnapper of her daughter. And she said, I don't want to become the person I hate. I was filled with rage and anger, and I wanted to kill the guy. But then I realized I was becoming him. And if I'm going to live the life that I want to live, I'm going to let go of that hate, and I'm going to let go of that anger. And you have to be ready for that. Nobody's going to instantly go to that.
Simon,
if somebody kidnapped my child, I would never forgive them. That would be an unforgivable act for me. But I wouldn't necessarily seek vengeance on them. You know, that would remain an unforgivable act for me. But it wouldn't. The opposite of not forgiving. Not forgiving and vengeance for me are not really that connected, you know, because I'm not a particularly, I'm not physically violent person. But I think, as I say, that would be an unforgivable act, but it wouldn't produce any vengeful acts for me, from me. I would just live with that feeling that this terrible thing had happened, and whether the perpetrator was looking to find peace and, you know, atone for what he'd done, that would sort of be his journey, her journey, whatever. But that would be definitely an unforgivable act. And I think in a way, you know, I'm older, I guess. I'm 60, and my parents they were the great generation that fought in the Second World War. They kind of had a lot of fortitude where they could live with really painful, unforgivable things and just live. That was part of life. You know, certain things, when you thought about them, they produce anger, rage, pain, and you can't look for a life where you don't have those responses to certain things, especially if they were unforgivable acts that were perpetrated on you.
Jeffrey, Dean, what do you want to add to that?
Well, it does seem to me, again, I keep making the same point. I don't like universal prescriptions on all of this. It seems to me that whether do we want vengeance or not, it depends on what you mean by vengeance. If by vengeance you mean something like private vigilante activity, then, of course, no civilized person wants vengeance. But one of the oldest stories in the literature of Western civilization is the story of the Oresteia, where in Aeschylus' trilogy, the rule of law is developed to take on the personae of victims and to act in a procedural, fair, and regularized way mm-hmm. to inflict harsh punishment on those people who do them wrong. And it seems to me that one of the ways, I hate this current term of psychobabble closure, but one way people sometimes get closure is not by forgiving, but they get closure by seeing the person who killed their child or did something terrible to them, raped them, see that person get their just desserts in a fair and just legal system. I mean, we tend to think that revenge is an awful thing if we think it's something like vigilante activity, or if we think of those pathological instances of it in literature, like Medea killing her children to get even with her husband for her sexual betrayal. But, you know, it's only extreme cases of these emotions that are interesting enough to be works of literature. I mean, you know, like any Irishman, I've gotten even with people for small wrongs in small ways, but they're not the sort of thing of which great literature could be written.
Jeffrey, it's funny that we're both Irish, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, Jeff, if you want to talk ahead, about Dean. Forswearing vengeance, you have to look at the end of vengeance in Belfast, when act of vengeance after act of vengeance led to 20 years of killing. And at a certain point, they said, we have to forswear vengeance. We have to give up that sense of revenge, or we're going to condemn our children to this hate for generations. And that's also true with Holocaust survivors. There's a movie I would recommend called Forgiving Dr. Mengele. This was a woman who was one of the Mengele twins. And she has gone on record as saying she's forgiven him. And there's a whole lot of other Mengele twins who are furious with her. But she says, this is how I've liberated myself from Mengele. I'm no longer living in hate. I've moved on with my life.
Which I think works for some people, but might not be the right prescription for everybody.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think Jeffrey's point about the universal prescription is really the key here. Because, you know, I've been through some rough stuff in my life, but nothing like that.
Right.
So I can't prescribe for other people how they handle these situations. And I think that's true of everybody, really. You can't prescribe.
I don't think anybody can prescribe for anybody.
Dean, I appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. If you've just tuned in, we're having an interesting conversation here about forgiveness, the power of forgiving, as many of us are told, to err is human, to forgive divine, or the value, the virtue, even, in holding a grudge. How about your own situation? How do you come to this conversation from your own experience? 651-227-6000 to the phones to Mary in Duluth. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi.
You've been talking about some things that I've actually experienced. Our daughter was kidnapped, she was raped, and she was murdered. All a random act of violence.
Oh, Mary.
The thing that I am not hearing in the conversation is time. It takes a long time to work through and get to forgiveness. I'd say I can't even remember how long it took me, but it took years of grief and loss and struggle. We actually have met with the offenders, and finally I was able to come to understand that forgiveness was really letting go of anger, and that freed me to live my life. And I actually, it just sort of happened, and then I realized that it happened, after, you know, kind of looking backwards of, oh, you know, I'm not waking up angry every day. And one thing that was said, I find that the fact that the offenders that took our daughter's life are in prison for the rest of their lives, that has given me, if you want to call it, closure. I'm glad I don't have to worry about them. You know,
Mary, do the offenders know that you've gotten to this place of forgiveness? Does that matter, or is
well? I haven't said to them, "I forgive you," but I think, and I don't feel a need to do that. They might, one especially might kind of feel that because we've continued to have contact with one, especially my husband, not so much myself. But to me, that's not important. I mean, it sounds crude, but I don't care about his feelings.
It sounds to me, and I mean, first of all, that's so devastating. I can't even imagine what you've been through. But it sounds to me like you might have, by being very intelligent, thoughtful, patient, you might have let go of anger. But I don't see that as being the same thing as forgiving. Like, to let go of anger, it must have been a long, painful journey that did involve meeting with these people and
humanizing them a bit, and it was a struggle that only somebody very strong could have undertaken. But to me, observing it without the full facts, it seems like you might have let go of anger but not actually forgiven, which...
Well, how
I think,
do you define forgiveness? That's
I guess
the
that's the important crux here.
Yeah, and that's what I had to come to, because originally I had a much different feeling that if I forgave, that I was saying that what they did was okay. But one of your previous callers said you can forgive and still hold somebody accountable,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I feel that I'm doing.
Well, I guess if that happens to me, I would aspire to eventually let go of the all-consuming anger that was ruining my life. But maybe my goal would be to do that without... And I think you may have done... I don't know, you might have done that. You might have... You've let go of this anger, but your forgiveness of the act, you know, you're still unforgiving of the what happened to your daughter, maybe.
No,
I don't know.
I guess that it's all in how you define it. It's not
yeah.
that I haven't, you know... I'm holding them accountable. They broke the law. They took a life. They're in prison. I'm not going to work to get them out of prison. And now maybe some people would say, if I've forgiven them, I should be doing that. But I don't define it as that way.
Mm.
So that's the thing, too. When you talk about forgiveness, I have learned that the very first thing I ask somebody is, how do you define forgiveness? Because there are many, many definitions.
Maybe it is separate from letting go of anger, letting go of that, you know, physiological corrosive anger that is a natural response but eventually can fade, but is not necessarily bound up with forgiveness, because it sounds to me like you're very comfortable with them being punished to the full extent of the law, which I would be too, which says to me that you don't really forgive the crime. You've just come to terms with the anger and managed it very skillfully, and just for your own psychological well-being.
But Jeffrey, again, we're not saying forgiveness equals condoning, right?
No, but I do think the issue raised about what do we mean by forgiveness, the definitional question, is very important, because I think that merely overcoming anger and hatred, for example, by itself, I would not call forgiveness. I mean, we tend to think of forgiveness as, if people who are high on it at least, think it's a kind of virtue. So it's not simply that you've overcome anger. You've overcome the anger for a moral or a spiritual or religious reason, out
yes.
of love or compassion or something.
Right.
Whereas sometimes what happens, and this will only happen, of course, with fairly small wrongs and injuries, sometimes over time you just forget about it. It doesn't play the role in your life it used to. And I wouldn't say in those cases you've forgiven the person. You just don't care anymore. Now, obviously, if something as awful as the story that was just described, you're never going to forget about that. But sometimes I think we overcome anger not because we are directing forgiveness toward the individual who wronged us or did something terrible to somebody we loved, but because psychologically we just can't stand processing this anymore. And so we're doing it in a way for our own mental health. We're not doing it because we feel a higher moral or spiritual or religious calling to forswear resentment and hatred and anger. It's that I just can't live peacefully with my own life anymore if I do this.
Mary.
And so I don't think there is such a drug, but suppose there was a wonderful drug that after some terrible atrocity had been inflicted upon you, you could take that drug and you wouldn't be overwhelmed by all those terrible feelings anymore. I think that'd be just fine, but it wouldn't be forgiveness, at least not in my view.
Mary, I thank you for the call.
You're welcome.
My friend Maureen on Twitter here says, definitely forgive, although it might be hard sometimes. Holding a grudge causes too much stress and negative energy. Here's another listener who says, I try to forgive myself first for any guilt, shame, disappointment I have for being involved in a situation that requires forgiveness. And Kristen says, forgive and move forward, learn the lesson, and don't forget. And Steph on the Daily Circuit page.
Advice columnist Amy Dickinson wrote into us. She says, forgiveness is often a path for a victim to heal. It's hard work and a high calling. And on a lighter note, Therese says, my 101-year-old great-aunt, who's spunky and sharp as a tack, recently learned of the death of her ex-husband's second wife. One of her friends in her Catholic retirement home suggested she pray for the soul of this woman, whom my aunt credits with ruining her marriage. Her response? She can rot in hell. I love that my great aunt tells it like she feels without sugarcoating her opinion or bowing to those who suggest she should forgive someone who did something she feels is unforgivable.
No forgiveness there for the second wife. To the phones here to Jason in Minneapolis. Hi, Jason.
Hi there.
Hi.
The perspective I have to offer is certainly not nearly as heavy as the previous caller, but I'm a historian professionally, mm-hmm. and I sometimes look at the lessons we learn from history, and one that stands out to me, I was a very small child when Richard Nixon was forced from office, and I have always remembered, just as a very young boy, watching that episode on TV, and the day that he left the White House, he said, and I can't quote it directly, I'll paraphrase, but something to the effect of, others may hate you, but if you hate them back, you will destroy yourself. And as I've studied history and specifically studied President Nixon, that is something that has always stuck with me. And just from a standpoint of taking that into my life, that's something I think about often in these types of scenarios.
Simon, what do you think of that?
Well, hate is like, it's a scary word. And people now in our pop psychology, they do equate it with this emotion that can be very corrosive to the individual who's experiencing it. But I think you cannot forgive somebody, and you cannot hate them at the same time. Like, to me, to identify an act as unforgivable doesn't necessarily mean, like I said before, that I'm seeking vengeance. It might not even mean that I hate the person. It might just be that I've defined a certain thing as an unforgivable act. And, I want to see justice for that act. I think, you know, a lot of those tweets that you read, they reflect that the current culture forgiveness has become, as Jeffrey pointed out, this word that pops up in 40% of the books. Didn't you say it was 40%?
Something like that in the self-help and recovery books.
Yeah, so I think people need to sort of step back and take a look at where we've landed with our pop psychology and hugging it out and flinging the word forgiveness around, and really sort of say, okay, when is the right time to use that? And the caller prior to this one with the lady who'd been through the devastating kidnapping was actually, I think, very important, because it showed that, I think what that lady described was a really intense process of coming to terms with the bewildering rage and anger of what she'd been subjected to. And she defined, when she reached peace, she defined that as forgiveness, but it didn't sound to me like that was her priority in relation to the perpetrators.
Right.
They were in jail. She was happy about that. She felt good about that. So maybe this word's just, we're slinging it around like cologne, and it's just needs to be reined in a bit.
Simon, I'm grateful you had time to chat with us this morning. We've posted your piece on our Daily Circuit page. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And Jeffrey's thoughts were so interesting. He's a lot smarter than me.
We're kindred spirits. When I read
too.
Your list and your essay of all those things that you are upset about at the moment, I thought, we have a lot in common, because they're all on my list, too.
So you're new friends, I hope. Thank you, Simon, very much. I want to grab Tim here to close our conversation in Grand Marais. Hi, Tim.
Hey.
Hi. What's your experience with this?
I'm a prosecutor, and I was shot by a defendant that I convicted in 2011. And ever since that time, I've been dealing with this issue of forgiveness. I think the first time, because people would ask me, have you forgiven? And I've never been able to answer the question, even to myself. First of all, because I'm not even sure what it means, but mostly because I'm stuck in some middle ground. I don't want to give any energy over to the person who hurt me, or other people who since then I feel have hurt me from the way they've responded to things. I feel like that's on them, on their plate, so to speak, mm-hmm. and I have to deal with my own issues. But I definitely don't know how you would, for instance, in the situation, in my situation, or the situation of the woman whose daughter was kidnapped and murdered, actually in any way let that those perpetrators off the hook morally. I mean, those things are just clearly wrong. And
do you feel that if you put the word forgiveness to however you're going to feel ultimately about this defendant who shot you, that you'd be making some kind of a concession that you just don't want to make?
I just feel like it's not on my plate, and I have so much to deal with myself, and I want to live my life in a way as best I can, I guess, going forward. And I can't expend energy on that one way or the other. I'm not saying it doesn't creep back on me. I'm also Irish, and I can get angry about it. I can feel hurt about it. I can feel afraid about it. But my conscious decision is to deal with the things that are in front of me, not the things that are behind me. I don't feel that I've forgiven, though.
Tim, I appreciate the call. I'm glad you heard the conversation and could join us.
Yeah, it was very good. Thank you very much.
And Jeffrey, thank you so much. I hope we talk again.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Murphy with us, professor of law and philosophy at Arizona State University. Continue to weigh in on the idea of forgiveness at the Daily Circuit page.
Programming is supported by Breezy Point Resort, offering over 200 accommodation choices, including condominiums, breezy inn and suites, private beach homes, and retreats with 4 to 11 bedrooms, along with golf, including Arnold Palmer's Deacon's Lodge. BreezyPointResort.com.